Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Lori Flores, your host for this episode, and I'm very happy to welcome Julian Lim here today to talk about her book, Porous Borders, Multiracial Migrations and the Law in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands, which just came out through the University of North Carolina Press at the end of 2017. Julian Lim is a professor and assistant professor of history at Arizona State University, and I want to welcome her to the podcast today. Julian, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me here.
I'm so happy to have you, and I'm so glad I got to read your book. Before we get started in talking about what's in it, I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners, something about your personal and professional background. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school, and what led you to the professional position you're in now, and what got you interested in writing this book?
I'm happy to speak about my personal trajectory. So I was born and raised in California, sort of the Bay Area, about 30 minutes, south of San Francisco, and went to UC Berkeley for my undergrad. Majored in English, took a couple of years off to figure out what I wanted to do. As a child of immigrant parents who were really invested in me going into the kind of traditional professional routes of medicine or law or business or something like that, I ended up going to law school at UC Berkeley as well. And then realized while I was in law school that I really loved law school and learning about the law, but I really did not enjoy practicing law. So, you can imagine how thrilled my parents were. I tried practicing for 1 year, and it confirmed my suspicions that my interests lay elsewhere. By the second year of my law school, I kind of realized that maybe practicing wasn't the path for me, and I had applied to graduate schools at that time. So by the third year, I knew what I kind of wanted to do, graduated, practiced for 1 year just to make sure that it wasn't going to work out for me, and then was lucky enough to have been accepted to Cornell, where I went to get my PhD in history. Working with Maria Cristina Garcia, who's a Latino historian, immigration historian, a major immigration historian as well, and Derek Chang, who was my sort of co-chair in Asian American history. And so I went to graduate school interested in thinking about history differently from the way that I had been taught it in high school and in college. So, you know, growing up in California and the Bay Area, especially, I grew up in a very diverse community and my family is very diverse, very mixed in terms of racial and ethnic and national origins. But, you know, when you get into the history classes, everything got so segmented. And so Latino history seemed very separate from Asian American history, very separate from African American history. And so on and so forth. But I knew that there was a lot of overlap, at least in my personal experience. And so I went to grad school interested in trying to find a way to study both Latino history and Asian American history together. It seemed to me that's just intellectually what I was interested in pursuing. And so I wanted to think about new ways of bringing these histories together. And in grad school, I happened to reread Mario T. Garcia's Desert Immigrants around the same time as Erica Lee's book, At America's Gates, where El Paso came up repeatedly as an important kind of border city related to immigration issues. And so I knew that my story had to begin with research in El Paso. So, you know, Mario Garcia's book had been about Mexican immigration. Erica Lee's book had been about Chinese immigration. A lot of these issues are happening around El Paso. And so I thought, oh, you know, this might be a really interesting kind of local history about a multiracial border city. And as I began to do my research, go into the archives, follow the path, it became a broader story about migration, immigration law, and ultimately a transborder immigration regime that reshaped I argue, race relations and national identities in exclusionary ways in both the United States and Mexico. And so that's how my personal and my intellectual kind of histories all came together in grad school.
Yeah. And your legal knowledge and expertise probably really informed the way in which you looked at this multiracial border environment, right?
Yes. Yeah. So as I mentioned, I really enjoyed law school, and I really enjoyed thinking about law and legal history and the importance of law. And so I've retained that emphasis on kind of a legal history, but the book is at the same time a social history. So I tried to kind of bring the high and the, you know, sort of it's top down, bottom up kind of history together in this book.
And you actually led me into the first question I was going to ask you, which is, you know, that your introduction situates us, the readers, in El Paso, Texas. And I was going to ask you, why start there? But you already started answering that question in terms of it's a nexus for so many different people living their lives, right? But could you speak a little bit more about how El Paso, the history of it, but also the, you know, the present day place of El Paso, how it can really turn a lot of our notions, what we think we know about the U.S.-Mexico border, on its head? Like, what do we not know right away about the U.S.-Mexico border that El Paso can teach us?
In terms of the introduction and the history of El Paso, it's a critical border city in the 19th century. It's the first sort of major border kind of entry point because of its sort of unique location as a nexus for, as I like that word, for all these railroad lines that come together. And so the second transcontinental railroad in the United States connects there. And then you have all these other kind of lines that then radiate out from there that connected to all these different kinds of geographies and regions in the United States, but also into Mexico, because by I think 1883 or 1884, there's a railroad line that connects Mexico City to the border, and then to all these other railroad lines. And so that transportation system becomes pivotal to bringing all these people to the border region, along with products and along with capital. And you just see, you know, by the 1880s, it's just booming. There's so much activity in terms of the industrialization, the kind of urbanization that happens in El Paso and in Juarez. And then all of this really, really diverse immigration that's occurring starting in the 1880s, not just Anglos and more Mexicans, but also a lot of other kind of European immigrants are coming, as well as, and this is what I talk about in the book, as well as also Chinese immigrants who are coming through Mexico to the U.S.-Mexico border, and then potentially trying to gain entry into the U.S. during the period of the Chinese Exclusion Acts, the exclusion era of the United States. And then there's, of course, African Americans who are suffering under Jim Crow. And so they're looking for freedom and might find it by moving westward, because that El Paso is at the most western point border of Texas, where Texas meets New Mexico territory, which is technically where the Jim Crow line ended. And so African Americans who were seeking sort of refuge from Jim Crow could either move westward and try to seek to escape those kinds of oppressions by following the train tracks that in that direction, or by going south into Mexico, which they had been long doing even since slavery times. And so it becomes a very interesting, a very diverse sort of multiracial border city. And that's where the book starts, kind of thinking about how do these opportunities arise, and then what happens to these multiracial opportunities. Today, the El Paso-Juarez border, what was your question? How does it illuminate?
Well, maybe we can save present-day El Paso perhaps for discussion towards the end, because I'd love to ask you about, you know, what the notion or your title, Porous Borders, can mean today. So maybe I'll save that. But I do want to go back to, you know, what you were saying in terms of the different people who are coming in and through El Paso. So we've got not only Mexicans, not only Anglo Americans, we've got African Americans, we've got Chinese origin people. And I, you know, what you say in your book is that when we think about the U.S.-Mexico border and the borderlands, we tend to just maybe imagine a story of Mexicans and Anglo-Americans, but we don't really put together that it's a border region with an incredibly multiracial history to it. And what you are trying to do is sort of disentangle all those threads and keep the border from being simplified in that way, that it's not just two race kind of story or two group kind of story, but that it's more complicated than that. And you talk about this history of erasure of the multiracial borderlands. So I want you to speak a little bit more about, you know, something you say in your book is that you really, in your work, wanted to move multiracial people from being objects of historical study to being subjects of historical study. Could you say a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Yeah, sure. But before I do that, I also wanted to mention, of course, that the rich diversity of the border region is also another group that contributes to the rich diversity, of course, are Native or Indigenous peoples who've been long there, you know. The Apaches in particular appear as well in the book as an integral kind of group that pushes on migration policy in certain ways. So I think, you know, what's exciting about when we're thinking about multiracial studies and histories is that, you know, a lot of the earlier work has been kind of recapturing the history kind of story, which is very important. But it's about kind of recovery. And so let's think about how these two different groups have come together. And a lot of it has been about sort of white and then non-white relations. And so there's different ways in which I wanted to expand our understandings of multiracial history to show not only how, you know, different groups who are also not white were coming together, who are both not white or non-white were coming together, but also how it wasn't just about laws that were just kind of coming down on and trying to regulate their relations, but also just kind of recapturing and thinking about how the ways in which different non-white racial groups were coming together compelled different authorities or the state to try to make sense of their relations. And so I guess what I was trying to do was capture their agency, right? In thinking about how do these Chinese, how do these Mexicans, how do these African Americans who are coming together in a very short amount of time in a very particular place, how do they come together? What sort of sense do they make of each other? What sort of relations do they build? And it's not always, I don't mean to suggest that it's always cooperative either, right? There's a lot of conflict as well. But I wanted to capture the sense of the richness of their experiences and the kind of sense that they were trying to make of their migrations and their encounters with all of these new different kinds of people. And then how they then respond to the way that the state tries to make sense of these multiracial relations and identities. And so that's, you know, how I tried to move them from just being objects of historical study to giving them a bit more agency and turning them into subjects of historical study as well.
Right. Well, I'd love to kind of go through each of your chapters and be able to give our listeners an idea of what you tackle in each of them. So in your first chapter, you do talk, this centers on those Native populations that you were mentioning. And, you know, making sure we know that the borderlands, the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, were an indigenous space. It was indigenous borderlands before it became this capitalist borderlands with the railroad and all these new forms of, you know, settlement and investment coming into the El Paso region and the broader area around it. So you say at the same time that the border was kind of opened, it was closed. And that particularly affected indigenous populations. Can you just tell us a little bit about the story behind that?
Sure. So the this section of the book, or especially this section of the chapter, the first chapter, is really building on a lot of the work that's been coming out in Western history and in Native American history, and thinking about empire in the West and the borderlands, and the ways in which manifest destiny was not so manifest or as destined as we might think of today. So I'm thinking in particular of Pekahama Malainen's work or DeLay's work, thinking about how indigenous groups and peoples were actually a force to be reckoned with by Anglo-Americans and Mexicans and Europeans before them. And so it was a kind of imperial borderlands where Native Americans had, an immense amount of power for so much well into the 19th century, well into the late 1880s. We have the Apaches really kind of giving the U.S. government and Mexico a run for its money in terms of thinking about who has power in this region. And so the story begins with thinking about how these indigenous groups have so much territorial sovereignty as well as power to control and regulate. And in fact, they're in some ways the first to regulate the entry of the Spanish and of Anglo-Americans, because, as Juliana Barr points out in a lot of her work, the Spanish really had to rely on the pathways and the friendships that they made with indigenous leaders to be able to survive in the region in the beginnings. And so the story is slowly about how the control over migration in the borderlands shifts over the course of the 19th century, in particular from the indigenous having a lot of the power to then, the Spanish and then Mexico, as well as the U.S. trying to assert its authority over controlling the border, especially after, the creation of the border in 1848. The border is kind of, in many respects, an imaginary line, but the need by both countries to control indigenous authority and power in the West makes the border a bit more real, because we start to see how these two countries start to collaborate and work together to eradicate the Apaches from the border region, and then how the Apaches, rely on the border and give the border political meaning, because U.S. Army or soldiers can't necessarily cross the border very easily to chase the Apaches across into Mexico, or and vice versa. Mexicans aren't supposed to cross into the U.S. to chase the Apaches. And so there's a way in which the border starts to have meaning. Migration regulation starts to become animated during this period, definitely by the 1880s. And then with the kind of capture of Geronimo, who's sort of the last holdout of the Apache resistors, I guess, and the removal of the Apache to reservations and sort of the curbing of Apache power, we do see kind of that closing, and I put that in quotes because I don't want to suggest that the indigenous are completely erased from the border region. But in terms of migration and the regulation of migration, it is a kind of closing of the border with regards to native mobility. And then we see this immense transformation of the border and ideas about migration and how do we regulate migration that comes with the coming of the railroads and industrialization and urbanization.
Mm-hmm. And with this sort of constraining of native mobility, there's also a facilitation of other people's mobility. So a lot of people, Mexicans, Chinese people, African-American people are moving through this border region a lot more in your second chapter, in the chapter that follows. And you are talking about all the different forms of refuge that people are seeking. In the book, you talk about how this multiracial constituency is coming into contact with each other through work, through play, on the streets, in their homes, through getting into conflict with each other, or in some cases, marrying each other. What surprised you about the different forms of contact that people are making, whether it's cooperative or ridden with conflict? What surprised you about what you found in your research?
thinking back, I was surprised by two things. By how rich the, by how much people were actually coming together. Mixing. They were, you know, there's an immense amount of coming together, mixing, conflict. It's interracial conflict. It's intraracial conflict. But there's also a lot of cooperation in the marriages, and the children and the families that are being born by all this mixing. And this idea that, you know, for example, in chapter two, what I try to trace out is the southern part of El Paso in the late 1880s and early 1900s, usually depicted as a predominantly Mexican, the predominantly Mexican part of town. It's called Chihuahuita, Segundo Barrio. But when I started to look into the records, I could see actually that the city directories, the census data was showing that it was actually a very mixed population. And actually, that's where a lot of the non-white mixing was happening. And it wasn't so it became a very, very it became very clear to me that there was a lot of mixing that was happening that hasn't been captured in history yet at that time. But the other part that surprised me was how hard it was to find records to show this kind of mixing. So it took a lot of work to be able to recapture this these multiracial dimensions, because if you go into the archives, you know, they're not, at least when I went in, they weren't organized to show multiracial relations. Everything's pretty segmented. You know, you might have African Americans in El Paso, you might have the Chinese in El Paso, Anglo, you know, or Mexican El Paso, but then you just have to really sort through and try to figure out how do I find this mixing that I'm intuitively kind of guessing must be there, because I know that all these people are coming together, and it can't be that they are totally segregated from each other at this time. And so it took a long time and a lot of despair and anguish, moments of despair and anguish, to finally find, oh wait, you know, these nuggets started to come through. I can, you know, you might spend hours looking through these folders, and then you might find one document. And you're like, this is, you know, it's like Eureka. You're like, I found it. And so that was the other thing that surprised me, just how hard it is to get at some of this history. But it's, you know, for me, it was well worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. You do. I think throughout the book, it's very clear how hard you worked in order to produce a multiracial history like this. And it's a reminder to those of us, you know, working on immigration or interested in interracial conflict, cooperation, interaction, that you have to really splice together a lot of siloed, you know, off information that also reminds archivists, like, maybe that sometimes is not the most productive way to organize information either. It helps us think about how can we do better in order to facilitate more scholarship that has a multiracial analysis to it. I think it's a really good reminder. When it comes to finding, you know, records of this contact, I'm sure that records having to do with policing certainly helped you get at that sort of community, ground level community study, and looking at people's lives on the ground. And your third chapter is about policing the border and policing the people who are moving through it and across it and near it. So who was doing the actual policing of the border?
Right. So, yes, policing is and police records are a very important part of, you know, sort of document available to us. And so actually in the second chapter, it begins with this case, these arrests of these mixed race couples who were Mexican and African Americans who had broken the Texas state law against miscegenation. And so those police records were actually very important, kind of thinking about mixed race relations in that chapter. In chapter three, the policing comes from the immigration officials. It's more a kind of, it's a story that where with chapter three, I'm trying to kind of broaden out the lens to think about the border as it's starting to develop. So dynamics that are happening in El Paso with this kind of multiracial, with these multiracial kind of crossings, elites in El Paso are starting to get concerned about what it might mean for their development as a as an American city. You know, we don't want to look too differently from what the from what Eastern U.S. cities look like, and so there's a lot of anxiety, and there start to be calls for the government from Washington D.C. to send federal agents, to send immigration agents, and to enforce the laws more actively, especially with regards to Chinese immigration. The Chinese Exclusion Act has been passed. We have all these Chinese immigrants still coming here. You know, this shouldn't be happening. We don't want to have a city that looks this diverse, or, you know, that doesn't match American expectations. And so there start to be these demands for more of more border regulation, more immigration regulation, and for more federal presence at the El Paso Juarez border to stem what they see as an influx of too much Chinese immigration, illegal Chinese immigration, in their opinion, right, into El Paso and into the country. And so that's where the policing and those INS records at in the National Archives are, again, another tremendous resource for historians who are thinking about, who are interested in immigration, but also these sort of on the ground interactions between immigrants and officials at the U.S.-Mexico border. There's a lot there about the Mexican border.
Yeah, those records are amazing, and there is just so much to go through. I mean, you could look at them forever.
I know, it's too much.
And when it comes to policing, when we think of the border, we, at least Americanists or people who are focused on the American side of this story, may think it's only the U.S. doing the policing. But what you actually talk about in your last couple of chapters is that this is a binational effort, that U.S. and Mexican law does converge at the border to be regulatory. And you have this really interesting chapter that concerns the Pershing punitive expedition, in which I learned a lot of new stuff that I didn't know before. Can you give our listeners an overview of that chapter, or those last couple of chapters?
Sure. So in chapter four, so up to this point, so chapter four deals with the Mexican Revolution, so the 1910s. And basically up to this point, Mexico has had an interest in regulating migration and immigration, but it's been a bit different. It had to take a different approach than the U.S. And so, you know, we can think about the example of the Chinese as this way in which Mexican immigration policy diverged widely from the U.S. And so the U.S. in 1882 passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. That coincides pretty closely with Mexico's policy of actively recruiting Chinese immigrants at that time, because the idea was not to keep out immigrants, but rather to woo, recruit, and try to bring in more immigrants to develop that northern border region, the northern frontier. And so it's not that Mexico has not had an immigration policy or has not been concerned about immigration, but it had a different kind of approach to immigration. And even though, you know, in the early, like I think in 1903 or 1904, it tries to start passing some regulations to more closely police Chinese immigrants and address complaints about the desirability of Chinese immigrants. These laws, they're not actively enforced. And then the Mexican Revolution disrupts a lot of that momentum anyways, because of, you know, the decade of kind of the chaos, really disrupts, you know, all aspects of Mexican governance. And so chapter four is kind of a pivotal turning point in terms of what's going on in Mexico, what's happening with the Chinese in Mexico, and what it allows for African Americans to kind of claim in terms of citizenship. And so just to kind of give listeners a kind of broad introduction to this Pershing expedition and what it meant. In 1916, Pancho Villa, sort of the infamous bandito, crosses the border, the U.S.-Mexico border, into New Mexico and attacks the small American city of Columbus. A couple of hundred Americans I have to go back and think of the numbers. But in any case, you know, Americans are killed. And then Pancho Villa retreats very quickly. And the U.S. immediately sends General John J. Pershing and the U.S. Army into Chihuahua to try to track down Pancho Villa and either return him dead or alive. And so the U.S. prepares and goes into northern Mexico on this what's called the punitive expedition. And in the process, you know, they never actually capture Pancho Villa, but the punitive expedition is very fascinating to me for a variety of reasons. So one interesting aspect of it was that it involved a very diverse kind of military population. And so you had not only sort of Anglo-American soldiers, you also had African-American soldiers. You also had Apache scouts who joined the military and helped them navigate the terrain in Chihuahua. You also had all of these refugees that then attached themselves to the company, to the expedition, and sought to return to the U.S. with them when they finally were called back in 1917. And so these are not only thousands of Mexican refugees, but also these really powerful Mormon colonists who had made settlements in northern Mexico. They flee as well as refugees. And then there's about a couple hundred Chinese immigrants who were in Mexico who attached themselves to the Americans and try to leverage that opportunity to get into the United States despite the Chinese Exclusion Act, because many of them are laborers. They would not be able to come into the country otherwise. And so it became a very interesting moment where I could think about this event in very multiracial ways. I mean, there were so many different kind of ways in which different groups were presenting themselves in different ways in terms of a political legal status. And so African Americans and Native Americans who were participating in the military expedition could kind of assert their status as American citizens and kind of use that citizenship status to military participation to clarify their citizenship status. While Mexicans, I argue, you know, they would have been, I think, under a common understanding, political refugees, people who had been, who were fleeing because of the political chaos, but they actually found it easier to cross the border and gain entry into the United States at that time by presenting themselves as laborers, available laborers, because there was such a demand for labor by Southwestern agriculture and different kinds of businesses in the Southwest. And so there you can start to see kind of how immigrants, again, being subjects, historical subjects, are shaping and fashioning their own legal and political identities at the border for their own purposes, to their advantage. And so Mexican immigrants realize it's better for them to present themselves as available laborers. In the meantime, this is when we start to see these Chinese immigrants try to refashion themselves from these excludable laborers who would have been restricted under the Chinese Exclusion Act. And they try to make an argument for themselves as political refugees who should gain asylum or, you know, gain refuge into the country. And those who attach themselves to the military and to Pershing are actually successfully able to do so. They are able to come into the country because of their attachment to the military for the service that they provided to the military while they were in Mexico, and then that they continue to provide to the U.S. Army in Texas while they're still kind of under sort of police control by the military. During World War I, as the U.S. Army there in Texas tries to prepare its soldiers for the European war. And so this episode for me was a very intense moment when we can start to see immigrants, migrants themselves kind of thinking about how to best navigate the different kinds of restrictions at the border during this moment of political chaos. And then chapter 5, the last chapter, thinks about how that border starts to take on a different shape or an even harder shape in some respects, because by this point, then with Mexico having, you know, gone through the revolution, is in a period of kind of consolidation and sort of new national building, rebuilding, it starts to assert its power to control immigration and the border a bit more aggressively. And so chapter five, we start to see not only the U.S. enacting very restrictive immigration laws, of course, the most infamous being the 1924 Immigration Act with the national origins quotas, but also Mexico during the 1920s and 1930s starts to take a more harder stance against Chinese immigrants and as well as African Americans. So there's a variety of orders to kind of have Mexican officials at the border police and kind of restrict African Americans from coming into Mexico, northern Mexico, well into the 1930s. And a lot of this has to do with Mexico trying to consolidate a new national identity around these notions of mestizaje and indigenismo, right? It's ironic because these are kind of mixed race celebrations of a mixed race identity based on sort of an Indian past, a romanticized Indian past, of course. But it's a mixed race identity that's being celebrated, but it came at the exclusion of Chinese Mexicans and African Americans or Black Mexicans, right? And so it was a very kind of exclusionary national identity that gets played out through the policing of migration at the Mexican border.
And we're still seeing that exclusion today. I mean, every now and then I'm reading an article, you know, on the internet about the exclusion of the, I think you call them the non-ideal mestizos of Mexico, right?
Right.
Afro-Mexicanos or the Chinese-Mexican population as well, and people with that sort of ancestry. So it's something that continues far beyond the temporal scope of your book, into the late 20th and now the early 21st century.
Yes, definitely. I think it's something that Mexico is still trying to come to terms with. And it's something I address a little bit in the epilogue as well. But you know, the book, let's say goal of the book was to kind of show how, as we've been talking about, the U.S.-Mexico border is a much richer kind of history than we typically think of. It's not just an Anglo-Mexican story, but it's this richer kind of multiracial history. But also to kind of think about how multiracial histories themselves got erased from the national histories of both the United States and Mexico, and the national identities of both the U.S. and Mexico. And, for so much of the 20th century, the 19th and 20th century, it's been about kind of erasing any kind of mixing and asserting a sort of monoracial structure of thinking about race. And it's not simply about white supremacy, right? Which it is for sure. But the 20th century was also defined by kind of erasing and ignoring and trying to do away with this idea that Americans of different kinds of racial and ethnic backgrounds were coming together, even though they were constantly. And so what I want to make sure that listeners understand is that my argument by the end is not that by the 1930s, all multiracial kind of relations disappeared, right? We know that they continued, but it's more that in national narratives, they were erased. And this is an active erasure that happens through migration and immigration policy from both sides of the border as well.
Yes, I think you do communicate that very well in the book. And I think what you do very well throughout the entire story that you tell us is, despite what the law is saying or doing or enacting, migrants or people in general are thinking much, much more richly than one side or the other, that they're interacting with each other across a lot of different borders. They're strategizing about their movement and their identity in richer ways than I think the authorities trying to police the border or craft legislation that divides people or simplifies people into one category or the other expect them to be doing. And so I think that definitely communicates that agency that I think you wanted to give the characters in this book. Yeah. So I'm really interested in learning more about what you're working on now. I mean, of course, we should be celebrating this awesome book of yours at this moment, but is there any project that you're working on that you're excited about?
So I actually have two. Well, I've got a couple of different projects kind of in the air right now. But so one is I want to finish, at least it's going to be an article, I think, that builds on sort of the observations of chapter one and something that you already kind of commented on, which is this idea that immigration, right, into this region of Chinese, Mexicans, African-Americans, Anglo-Americans, Europeans, that it was conditioned on or dependent on this idea of native removal. And these, you know, it's obvious for us to kind of think about and sort of recognize today, but it's not something that's actually been kind of explored so much by historians. Native American history is very separate from, in lots of ways, from discussions by immigration historians, right? We are two kind of bodies of historians, areas that seem to not really talk to each other very well. And so I'm trying to work on an article that is focusing on, again, the U.S.-Mexico border and particularly the Arizona region, and thinking about how demands for the regulation and the removal of the Apache and of Native Americans morphs into demands for the federal regulation of the border with regards to Chinese immigrants, and that these are kind of connected actions and histories. And so that's one article that I'm hoping to finish this year. The other two major projects, more book-length projects, has to do, they kind of go in different directions. So the first one is a history of marriage priorities in U.S. immigration law. So it's a broader kind of immigration history that's not solely focused on the U.S.-Mexico border, but it's thinking more broadly about different ways in which marriage has been, and different kinds of marriages have been prioritized over time since the 19th century. And then the second one is a much more, it's still very much in the like early research phase, but I'm interested in thinking about the Hispanic Caribbean as a kind of maritime borderlands where empire and U.S. immigration law come together and work in a variety of ways to shape migration from and between the mainland and the territories. So those are a couple of the different projects that I think take a lot of my interest from this first book into these new directions. I hope we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, they all sound like awesome projects. I can't wait to see more from you. But in the meantime, I think everybody should go check out Julianne Lim's book, Porous Borders, Multiracial Migrations and the Law in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands, out from the University of North Carolina Press. Julianne, I want to thank you so much for joining me on this episode today.
Thank you, Lori. Thanks for letting me share all this information about my book.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the New Books Network. I'm Lori Flores, your host for this podcast episode, and we've just heard from Julianne Lim about her book, Porous Borders. I invite you to like and follow our New Books Network social media pages on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you for listening.